Okay, we're starting here on the bottom of Chof Amud Bet by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Chanut shebechatzer yachol limchot biyado, v'lomar lo eni yachol lishon mikol hanichnasim mikol hayotzim. Person opens up a store in a chatzer. Another member of that chatzer can say, I cannot handle the amount of traffic that is going to traverse here, and therefore I want you to close the store down. You have a right to do that. Now, the way that it's phrased in the Mishnah is saying that it's not that you may not open up a store over the objections of your fellow B'nai Chatzer, but rather, any time the B'nai Chatzer feel that the amount of traffic is too much, they have a right to ask the person to shut it down, because they don't want people coming in and out. They don't want customers entering and exiting from their Chatzer. Aval, but a person has a right, Osekilim, Yotzei Umocher B'toch HaShuk. Person has a right to have his workshop inside of his house, and then go out of the chatzer to sell whatever it is, all that these items are, in the shuk. And therefore, the v'einu yachol limchot biyado, the people living in that chatzer don't have a right to say to him, lomar lo eni yachol lishon lo mikol ha-patish, not because of the noise from the hammer, v'lo mikol ha-rechayim, not the noise of the mill, v'lo mikol ha-tinokot, and not from the voices of the children. So what it seems over here is that you have a right in your residence to have your workshop and to do the work of your panasa inside of your house. And again, we saw that a little bit in the Gemara before, what said Dira Shiny, that when you open up your business, the business is opened up inside of your residence. And therefore, that's considered to be normal usage of the property of the house. And same thing over here. Many places we see in the Gemara that their house consisted of two rooms, an inner room and outer room. One of them was his workshop, his parnasa, and the other one was the living space. And that's considered to be normal, and you can't complain about the noise. Given that, then why can they complain about the noise of the people entering and exiting? So what you have to say is, in the ratio of the Mishnah, when they say the volume of customers entering and exiting, it's not just the noise that they make, but there's other damage that they do. Whether it's hezek riyah, whether it's hezek from the damage they do just from walking and traversing that area, theft, all sorts of other things that bringing in a ton of people into the chatzer causes a problem for the neighbors, and that they can object to. Not necessarily because of the noise, or even because of the noise. They have a right to do that because there are many other things packaged together with the volume of customers coming in and out of the chatzer. What they can't stop is someone who's doing his profession or working in his profession inside of the chatzer. Now, at the end of the Mishnah, when it says, Melamed Tinokot, both Rashi and Tosafot note that the Avamina is that the Tinokot that are mentioned in the Mishnah are children that are coming to buy on behalf of their parents from whatever is being sold in the Chatzer. And so the Gemara now is going to be bothered. Why in the ratio of the Mishnah do you say that a volume of customers is a problem? And in the Sefer of the Mishnah, you're saying that the volume of customers is not a problem. And that's the first question of the Gemara. Mishnah ratio, Mishnah Sefer. So Amar Abaye, Abaye says, Seifa Atan the Chatzer Acheret. That has to do with a member in a different Chatzer. Whereas the members of a Chatzer can object to someone opening up the business in their courtyard, the B'nai Mavoi, the people who are joined together in this Mavoi, where there are multiple Chatzerot that enter into this Mavoi, those people cannot object. Someone in another Chatzer cannot object to you opening up the business in your Chatzer, even though it's going to bring more customers into the Mavoi. That they can't object to. In a private area, in a private domain like a chatzer, you have a right to object because your house opens into the chatzer and you do a lot of personal activities there. In the mavoi, which is a more public area, there the b'nei chatzerot acherim, the people who live in other chatzerim, do not have a right to object to this person in this chatzer if all his neighbors agree to open that he can open it up. They can't stop him. And even though they have joint traffic in the mavoi, they don't have a right of rejection. If that's the case, let the Mishnah explicitly say it. Instead of saying Tinokot, just simply differentiate between in the Chatzer or in Chatzer Acheret. That's not where the language of the Mishnah is. Elohama Robo, Robo offers an alternative, Seif Atan the Tinokot Shabbat Rabban. The Seif is talking about a cheder, a location or a place where they're teaching young children. Omi Takanat Yeshua ben Gamla Veilach. And that is from the Takana of Yeshua ben Gamla and onwards. What seemingly Rava is saying over here is that the cheder is the equivalent of the workshop of this individual. He's a teacher. And therefore, having the children there is as if he has his workshop, whether it's like a mill running or whether it is someone who's working with a hammer and they're making noise, so too, the children are part of this individual's workshop, and we allow them to do this in the chatzer over the objections of the other parties that are there. The other aspect of that we will discuss later, but the other part of it might be the fact that these are limudei kodesh. And where it says, Amar Yehuda Amarab, Ram Zohor Isha Tov, Yoshua Ben Gamla Shemo. This person is remembered in the positive light, and his name is Yeshua Ben Gamla, because Shimaleihu Nishtrachav Tor Meisrael. For when not for him, Torah would have been forgotten from Klal Yisrael. Now Yeshua Ben Gamla already is somewhat questionable in terms of the character, because as the Baal Tosafot point out, we have a Gemara in Yevamot that tells us that Martyr by Baitus, who was a very wealthy widow, who ended up marrying Yeshua Ben Gamla, paid off Yanai Melech in order to have Yeshua Ben Gamla made into the Kohen Gadol. Now, there is a Yeshua Ben Gamliel that is mentioned in Josephus, which would, if you say, matches Yeshua Ben Gamla, and he lives at the time of the Churban. He's actually the Kohen Gadol near the time of the Churban and is killed as part of the Churban. And then the king that we'd be speaking about would be Agrippus II, who was the king at that time of the Churban HaBayit. But if you do that, now you have a story here in the Gemara which is extremely positive on Yeshua Ben Gamla. And they have a negative story in Yevamot. The way that Tosafot deals with it is to simply bifurcate the two issues and say, with regards to this issue of Torah and setting up a system of institutionalizing the teaching of Torah, over there Yoshua Ben Gamla was a great tzaddik. And that doesn't change the fact that he was a great tzaddik. When it came to being the Kohen Gadol, yes, he was a tzaddik, but there were people who were more appropriate for the position than him. And the fact that his wife paid off the king for him to be the Kohen Gadol was inappropriate. And again, it might not even speak to him. It might be about his wife who wanted him to be the Kohen Gadol, and she paid the money in order for him to be the Kohen Gadol. So Tosa just sees a simple bifurcation, which is, over here, he did the right thing, he was a big tzaddik. Over there, it was the wrong thing. Now it's interesting because the Baal Tosafot and many other places in Shas, when faced with these issues, usually say, Trey Yoshua Ben Gamla. They'll just say that there are two people named Yoshua Ben Gamla, and that is the alternative solution over here, to say that the Yoshua Ben Gamla that we're speaking of over here is not the same Yoshua Ben Gamla that is being spoken about in the Gemara in Yevamot. And if you do that, then obviously there is no stira. The fact that Tosafot, who usually uses that answer, doesn't say it over here, gives strong evidence of the fact that we are speaking about the same Yeshua Ben Gamla, and then you would have to answer like we did before, that you have to bifurcate the issues. You should remember this individual, Letov, and his name is Yeshua Ben Gamla, Shimaleihu Nishakach Torah Yisrael. Without him, Torah would have been forgotten from Klal Yisrael. Shibitchila. In the beginning, Mishish lo av milamdo Torah, someone who had a father would teach him Torah, like the classic sense of Misorah, which is from father to child. Mishin lo av lo yalamed Torah. Someone who didn't have a father didn't have the opportunity to learn Torah. Gemara here explains the problem as being a very parochial issue with regards to children who did not have fathers. Obviously, you could see the problem expanding beyond that problem, which is even children with fathers that don't have the capability or capacity to teach their children Torah, the same problem would arise. You could have a father and still have this problem. Maidarosh, what was his drasha? It says, Bilmaratem utam, that you must teach them. That's the obligation on the father to teach the child Torah. But then they read it instead of Bilmaratem utam, Bilmaratem atem, that you should teach them. I mean, there's an obligation on the community as a whole to ensure that the children are taught. It's not just your obligation to teach your own child, but you have a separate obligation which is to ensure all children are taught the Torah. Itkinu she'moshevim melamdei tinokot b'Yerushalayim. So then the first solution was to set up schooling system in Yerushalayim, by which there was a public school in Yerushalayim. Maidarosh, well again, what was the drasha? Ki mitzion teitzei Torah. From Tzion, from Yerushalayim, Torah will emanate. Now this is a beautiful idea. If you look at the Baal Tosafot, they explain why that was important. He says, Lefi, Shayer Roeh Kedusha Gedola. When he came up to Yerushalayim, he would say the great Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash. V'kohenim oskim ba'avudah. And the Kohenim engaged in the Avodat Hashem and the Mikdash. Ha'im echaven libo yoter li'rat Shemayim. That was inspirational and gave him a sense of awe that would encourage him to learn Torah. And he explains over here the story by the Mikra Bikurim, that people used to go up to bring the Bikurim, or to bring the Maaser Sheni up to Yerushalayim. And he says that that was a mitzvah gedola. Why was it a mitzvah gedola? Because it brought people to a different sense of Avodat Hashem. You get to Yerushalayim, you see that everybody is engaged in spiritual pursuits, is involved in things that are for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this encourages, inspires the individuals to learn or to engage at a different level. So going to Yerushalayim was the place that was picked because of its particular impact and influence on those individuals who go to Yerushalayim. So this is an important aspect of Aliyah Regel. The Aliyah Regel is that even though a person lives in a particular place, a particular region, and again, even if they are like the greatest individual in that place or region, sometimes you need to go up to the Beit HaMikdash, to go up to the center of Torah, to be reminded that there are people that are greater, to remind themselves that they're part of a greater mission or a greater Klal Yisrael. So too here, with Limud HaTorah, they centered the public schools in Yerushalayim. But dying, the problem still persisted. Someone who had a father would take him up to the public school and he'd get taught. The person who didn't have a father to take him up to Yerushalayim still was in the same bind. So then they established that they would put schools or public schools in every region. So in the bigger general regions, they would have a central public school. And then kids at the age of 16 or 17 used to come to the regional school because the age was important. It was too far from home. So only kids who were old enough that could actually either stay over and dorm there, or children who could travel that distance to the regional school, they were the ones who went to school. The younger kids either couldn't dorm, or they couldn't make the trip to get to the public school. So they only started at 16 or 17. The problem with 16 or 17 is, Mishaya Rabo Kwe Salav, if his Rebbe got angry at him, Miva'et Bo Ve'yotza, that he would kick off his Rebbe and walk out. You know, when you're dealing with 16 and 17 year olds, if they're not happy with what's going on, they walk out. They're not in an age where they're still malleable, where they're still can be influenced. They have their fixed ideas. If they're not happy with what's going on, they rebel and they walk out. So here is the institution of Yishuv Ben Gamla, V'tikein. So here he established that the public school system should move to the point where every city or every local area would have its own school. And then they brought him into school at 6 or 7. So now the age drops because of the fact that the school is local. At this point, you don't need to sleep over. You don't have to have a dorm. You can walk to school. Everybody can get to school. And if it's reasonable to bring the kids in at a much younger age. Tosafot over here says that if the child is strong, whether that means physically strong or whether it means he has the academic capacity to do it, then he would come in at 6. If not, he would start at 7. It's similar to a genre of answers that the Gemara gives in Arachin. Gemara in Arachin, at the beginning of Arachin, gives a list of items in terms of chinuch, and over there many times it gives 2 ages. And again, it speaks about the same thing. It speaks about a child that's more mature starts at the younger age, one who's less mature starts at the second age. Now, Ben Shesh or Ben Shev is interesting only because of the Mishnah and Avot. Mishnah Avot says, Ben Chamesh, the Mikra, which is at 5 you start learning Mikra. Tosafot raises the issue already. Either you have to suggest that you could start him at 5, but there's a risk if you start him at 5 that it will weaken the child or cause the child to somehow not have the capacity to continue or the physical capacity to continue. Or you could argue that from Chamesh is the father's obligation. Those are the basics. You teach him Aleph Bet, you teach him how to read, little things that the father can do. When we go to full schooling, or a full day of schooling, that's when he's Ben Shesh u Ben Sheva. So 5 is a slow start. It's equivalent of pre-K, or something to that effect. Trom Chuva. And then after that, once they enter into the main system, that's at 6 or 7. Amalei Rav, the Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat. So Rav says to Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat, If you remember, we saw Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat earlier, which is Rav asked him what he was doing in his garden. How did he leave his charges? How did he leave these young children that he was an expert teacher? And why did he leave them? And he says, this last 13 years, I haven't left the cheder once. I never left my children once. This is the first time I've seen my garden in all these years. And even now, when I'm in my garden, I'm still thinking about those kids. This is a beautiful idea. But he was an expert teacher. So here we have a number of pieces of advice that Rav is giving to Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat, this teacher of children. One is, Ad Shit Lo Tekabel. Until six, do not accept these children in the cheder. Don't accept them in the school. Mikan Ve'elech, Kabil V'asfilei Kitorah. From that point forward, you should accept them and stuff them like a shore, like an ox. It's an expression, asfilei, is a forced feeding. It's when they feed the animals, either to fatten them up or to strengthen them, they force feed them. You can only do that when the animal is big enough that he could handle taking on that amount of food and feed, and then you can push it into his mouth and force him to eat it. So over here, asfilei ketorah, it might have the double meaning, which is wait till they're old enough that they can take the material, but once they can handle the material, you should push them to take a lot of material. You force it into them, which means that have high expectations. Set a high standard because children are like sponges and you can give them a tremendous amount and push them along because they will take it or they will be able to understand it. So Amalei Rav the Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat, Ki machit the yinoka, when you hit the children, lo timcheil ba'arkat ha'misano. It's a beautiful idea that even if you have to hit the children, you should only hit them with your shoelaces. So it's clear what Rav is saying here, that sometimes it's appropriate to indicate to the child that there's something wrong, but you have to hit them in a way where it doesn't really hurt. You hit them in a way where they understand the meaning of what you're saying without causing them tremendous physical pain. And then he says, the kari kari, those that are capable or those that learn how to read, let them read. The dolo kari, those that don't know how to read, liavit savto the chavre, he should be a buddy or chavruta to his friend. So again, you can read this in a number of ways, which is that even the children are slower to pick up the reading, don't throw them out, just let them join with the other children, and eventually they'll pick it up through osmosis, because they'll be a chavruta, they'll be there, and they'll hear the other children doing it, and slowly but surely they'll also pick it up and learn along with the other children. Or you could argue that the listening itself is valuable. That even if they don't know how to read, just them hearing it, they eventually will get it to be able to do it bal peh, even though they can't actually read it. So even though they won't reach a point of literacy, they still will have the knowledge that is useful over here, because they would be reviewing it bal peh. For a number of those reasons, it's worth keeping the children in the school system and not pushing them out, even if they're not attaining the goals that we're setting out for them early on. Meitevei, echad mibnei chatzer, shebikesh lasot rofe, uman, vegardi, umalamei tinokot, bnei chatzer makvin alav. So over here, you have a question on the solution of Rava to our Mishnah. The solution of Rava to our Mishnah was that we're going to divide the Mishnah in half. The first half of the Mishnah is occupations, which we don't allow you to engage in over there because of the traffic flow in the chatzer. The one exception to that is Malameid Tinokot. He's the exception to the rule because probably the necessity for it, as well as the fact that it's a Davar Shebikdusha, and the fact that it's only Kol Torah, it's not the Kol of a Rechaim or a Patish. So we say to the Bnei Chatzer that you have to live with this type of noise, with this type of interference, because it's such an important thing for the community as a whole that we're going to allow it. That's what Rava said. If the reason is community service, then you could argue even for secular issues that are community service that it's allowed. If you say because it's a Davar Shebikdusha, then it would only apply to a Davar Shebikdusha. You might require both, which is that it's a service to the community as well as a Davar Shebikdusha, which is likely the way that people would look at this and say that only if you meet all of those standards, then we would allow you to do something like this. But here, now we have a braita that seems to indicate otherwise, which is, if one of the people lives in the courtyard, he wants to be a doctor. Now Rashi, interestingly enough, interprets rufe here to be a mohel, a person who gives a brit milah. He was considered or classified as a mohel here, not a rufe in the sense of doctor. Probably, or likely, they were the same trade at that time. You have an uman, which Rashi translates here in other places as well as mekiz dam, someone who is a bloodletter. Vigardi is a weaver. The last one is umelameid tinokot. So obviously the problem for us is here you can object to umelameid tinokot, whereas the way that Rava is solving the Mishnah, you're not allowed to do that. You can't stop the umelameid tinokot. So now b'nei chaser makvinolav, and here the Braita says you can stop them. In terms of the first couple of them, the rofe and the uman is because of the traffic. People are coming in to go to the bloodletter. People are coming in to get the mohel or to use the mohel. If he is also doubling as a rofe, you could understand that as well. The gardi, the weaver, is interesting because even though, as Potosva points out over here, that the gardi doesn't have a noisy occupation in and of itself. He doesn't have a mill. He doesn't have a hammer. He's a weaver. So maybe you could argue, right, that the shuttle and the moving back and forth, that that makes noise. Tosafot doesn't think that's the problem. He says it's simply the problem of traffic. That Nechasim and Yotzim are very heavy traffic for weavers. And therefore we're not going to let you have a workshop as a weaver and allow customers to come in and out because the traffic flow is too great. And obviously the last one, which is our problem, is the Mamed Tinokot. So, Achamai Eskinot, what are we dealing with over here? Betinokot Da'akum. Speaking about non-Jewish children. So now, this is very interesting, because now we're talking about a school. So it is a service to the community, but it's a service to the community that is broader than the Jewish community itself. It's a really public school where they're teaching secular studies. They're not teaching Torah over there. And that you can't object to. So the objection could be for one of two reasons, which is there are more people coming because it's a broader service to the whole community. Or you could argue because it's a secular subjects that we do not allow that, or you don't have the rights then to bother the other bnei chatzer. Tashma, shnayim shiyoshvim bechatzer, b'geish echad mehem nasot rofe v'uman v'gardi u'melameid tinokot, chaveiro ma'akev alav. So here, any of these occupations that the other individual in the chatzer wants to engage in, the other party who shares the chatzer with the courtyard with him can object. Gemara says again, achanami b'tinokot akum. Also over here, we're talking about non-Jewish students, but the idea being not that they're solely non-Jewish students, just that the fact that you have non-Jewish students means that the subjects that are being taught are secular subjects. Tashma, mi sheish lo bayit b'chatzer ha-shutafim. Person has a house in a joint courtyard, a courtyard that is shared by many houses. Rezeh lo yaskirenu. He may not rent it out. Lo l'rufe, v'lo l'uman, v'lo l'gardi, v'lo l'sofer Yehudi, v'lo l'sofer Aramai. So now you're in a little bit of a bind, because here the Braita explicitly separates between a Sofer Yehudi and a Sofer Aramai. So that's a Jewish and non-Jewish teacher. It seems that the Braita is indicating that you can't have a Jewish teacher and a non-Jewish teacher. And by definition, the difference would be that the Jewish teacher teaches subjects that are Kadosh, and the non-Jewish teacher is teaching the secular subjects. Once you've done that, then you've now say that there's an objection to both parties opening up their shop inside of the chatzer. So your answer before was to separate between Dvarim Shibikdusha to secular studies. Now all of a sudden you have a breakdown that includes both of them and saying you could object to both of them. My answer is Akamaiskina and the Sofer Mata. So taking about the case where he's the Sofer of the city. So Rashi reads that the Sofer Mata over here is the, I'll call it, maybe he's the regional teacher, Melamed Tinokot Ha'ir, a Moshiv Melamdim Tachtav. He's the equivalent of a principal or a teacher who has assistants that are working there, or teachers that are working around him, but we're talking about a large school. We're not talking about a single class or a single school run by one teacher. Here you're talking about a much bigger enterprise. And that's the problem, according to Rashi, is that you're not dealing with something small and manageable. You're dealing with something like an entire school, like the way we would think of today, that's coming into their chatzer now, and that's not acceptable. That's just too much. The noise is tremendous from that. Tosafot, on the other hand, does not like that explanation. And he says, V'sofer mata, eini rather fresh k'perish ha-kuntris. Says, I don't think that Rashi is right about that in terms of kol gadol. Because we're going to see in a second, coming up in the Gemara, in the second half of today's daf, which is actually a Gemara that we stumbled, but we'll see again that it doesn't fit so well within what is being said in that Braita. And he says, I also don't like what Rashi says in Boba Metzia to explain what a sofer is, which is that he is a barber. Sofer Mata is the misafer, the one who is cutting the hair, or the barber of the locale. So I don't like the fact that he's saying it's, he's like a big school principal or teacher, or that he is a barber. Now he comes and explains that he thinks to me like the Rabbeinu Hananel, that he is Kotev Shtarot Eir. He is the documenter, he's the real sofer of the city. He's the one who does all the contracts for the city. And again, the problem here is traffic, which is that everybody's coming in and out in order to get their things documented, to have contracts drawn up, or to have him help them with contracts or whatever letters they want to write. So therefore, it's again a traffic problem, but a bigger traffic problem because it's not limited to the students that are coming each day. It's traffic from anybody who needs the services of the sofer. And again, we're talking about the sofer mata, which is he is the primary person in this occupation in the city. So everybody is going to come to him. The Rabbeinu Gershom brings over here that either the sofer mata, shum sofer ayir, like the Rabbeinu Hananel, that he's a sofer shekotev shtarot, usfarim dechol, matzim akiv, there you can stop him. Ve'itim efarshet, some explain, the sapar mata, shmegaleach kol b'nei ayir, that he is the barber. So the Rabbeinu Gershom brings Rashi's interpretation from Bava Metzia, and he brings also the Rabbeinu Hananel. Again, Rashi thinks that he is just a larger school or principal of sorts, and the Tosafot rejects that based on the Gemara in the second half of today's daf. So Amar Rava, mitakanat Yeshua ben Gamla ve'elach, lami matin and yinoka mimato lemato. We don't bring children from city to city, aval mi beknishta lebnei knishta mimatina. But from shul to shul, we will force you to take the child. If there's a river between those two areas, we don't force you to move the child. If there is a bridge, titura is also used to describe the part of the tefillin that is considered to be like the bridge across the tefillin. Mimatina, then you can, even over a river, bring the child. Ve'ika gamla, on the other hand, if it is a, not a full-fledged bridge, but just like a board across the river, a plank that goes across the river, that they use a rope and planks and you walk across the river, lo mimatina, then we don't bring them. So here, the Gemara basically lays out, and Rashi summarizes this, which is, if there is sakana baderech, if there is danger in the child traveling to school, then we do not compel the parent to take the child to school in that area. And he can then compel the local parents to open up a school in that area, because otherwise he's going to have to travel in a way that ends up endangering the child. And Rashi says over here, Satan mikatreg baderech, right? They, from Yaakov Avinu, when he tells his children when they're taking Binyamin down to Mitzrayim, that why is that more dangerous than him staying home with his father? It's because they shem yikra ason. That on the derech, when you were traveling, there's many more risks, and the satan is mekatered baderech. So the Gemara here is saying the same thing with regards to a child. We're not going to force a child to travel in order to get to school if it's dangerous for him to get to school. How do you determine what's dangerous? Whether it's reasonable to ask the child to go from this location to that location. If he doesn't go to the shul that's right next to your house, but the one two blocks away, that's fine. That's, you can demand that they aggregate and they put a single school together for all the children. If you're asking to go from city to city, that's too much to ask both from the physical capabilities of the child to travel that distance, as well as the dangers involved in traveling that type of distance. And so because of that, you can force them to open a school. And the same thing with the river. If the river has a proper bridge across the river, then to ask the child to cross the river to the other side of the city, that's reasonable. If it's a bridge made out of stone and secure, then it's reasonable. On the other hand, if it's a gamla, if it's just a plank across the river, that's risky to ask a child. It could be washed away by the water, he could fall off, or if it's made out of wood instead of out of stone, so it's not a permanent structure. Whatever the reasons are, that's already too much to ask for a parent to have a child go that distance in order to be at school, and therefore they can compel them to open up a school locally. Now, Tosafot here qualifies that statement based on the next line in the Gemara. I'll just mention it here, and then we'll come back and discuss the Tosafot. He says, that's only true. It's only true if they have sufficient children in this locale to set up their own school. All right, so that comes from the next line in the Gemara, which is Amar Rava. Sach mikrei darduki 25 yinokei. The maximum classroom size for a teacher of children is 25. Ve'ika chamshin, if you have 50 modvin entree, then you split into two classes of 25 each. So obviously there's a problem here, which is, Rava says that the standard or the maximum classroom size is 25, but he's saying to you, you only have to open up a second class if there are 50. Well, that means that from 25 until 50, what exactly do you do? Ve'ika arba'in, if there are 40 mukminan resh duchna, then we set up a sayat, or a teacher's assistant in the classroom. So they get another teacher, not full-fledged teacher, but an assistant teacher in the classroom. Umisain le mimato. And the people of the city need to pay for the assistant. And that we don't force the teacher to take out of his salary, reduce his salary to hire the assistant. It's the obligation of the city who's hiring him to also hire the assistant teacher when you reach 40. Now, so now you again have a problem. You know that from 40 until 50, there's an assistant teacher. At 50, you split the class. Question is, from 25 until 40, what do we do in that situation? And here, Tosfot says, under 25, you can't force the other people of the city to open up a school. So the way Tosfot reads it, both here and in the previous case, is that this 25 is the threshold by which you can demand that they open up a local school, as well as the fact that you can demand parents of the area to contribute to have a school locally. Even if there's a better teacher in the next locale, once you have sufficient children in this particular location, you can compel them to open up a school and compel the parents to pay for the melamed to be there. Tosfot sees this as a minimum rather than a maximum. This is the minimum to demand that there be a school locally. The simpler way to read the Gemara is that you open up a school for even less than that, and that's the way the majority of the Rishonim read this. That this 25 threshold is not a threshold to determine when you have to set up a school. It's a classroom size, not when you set up a school. And therefore, even for less children, you would set up a school, or we'd force the local people to pay together, pool together their resources, and hire a teacher, even if there were less than 25. Again, Tosfot's clear here that he thinks that is a minimum. Almost all the Rishonim disagree with Tosfot over here and think that, and you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom, that unlike the Tosfot, he says, that until 25, one person can teach them, and beyond that, they can't teach them. So now the question of what to do from 25 to 40, in that when it's 40 to 50, they have to hire an assistant, what do they do from 25 until 40? Either you have to say that 25 is the optimal number of talmidim that should be in a classroom. Up to 40 is tenable. And then from 40 and onward, it's not tenable without an assistant. That's one way to read it. That from 25 to 40 is okay, it's just not the optimal way to deal with it. You could argue that by 40, is that at 40 we force them to put in an assistant into the classroom. But between 25 and 40, we don't force them to pay for an assistant in the classroom, even though it might be suggested or recommended that you have an assistant from 25 until 40. The people of the city cannot compel each other to put in an assistant until there are 40 kids in the class. That might also be a question as to how experienced the assistant teacher has to be, which is, do you have, from 25 to 40, you have to hire an assistant, but not a qualified, certified assistant. But from 40 and onwards, maybe you have to hire a certified assistant. And a question of who this Reish Duchna is. Duchan is like the Kohanim. When you talk about Duchan, is a platform. Platform is where the teacher sat, or where the people who were important sat up on the Duchan. So Reish Duchna is someone who listens to the teacher and then reviews the material with the children. So he's like a Chazara Rebbe in that sense. Or some say that he is an older student within the classroom, that he's already graduated from being in the student chair, sits up with the Rebbe, but he's still a student in the classroom, but he's more advanced than the other students, and therefore he's able to participate or help in the teaching of the younger students. Or you could simply read it, which is that, so some read Iikarbaim means until 40, which means that from 25 to 40 you hire an assistant teacher in the classroom. Once you reach 40, we force them to split the classrooms into two of 20 and 20. So that means that up till 25, you have a single teacher. From 25 to 40, you have a single teacher with an assistant. At 40, we already force you to split the classes. Whereas the Rosh thinks over here, 25 to 40, you still remain with the single teacher, even though it's not the optimal way to teach necessarily. And then from 40 to 50, we force you to take in an assistant. And once you hit 50, you have enough for two classes. And then we force you to hire a second teacher. Vamarava, hi Mikre Yanoke. If you have a young teacher of children, the Goris, that is a teacher, and he's going over the material. Goris over here means the memorization of that which they are learning, which is the way that they learned in terms of Tanakh, which is they went through the Tanakh, and they slowly but surely learned the whole Tanakh about Ben. Goris is to teach over and over again the same material, to review it in a way that they remember it. Bikachrina, the Goris Tfei Minei. But you have someone who is either more erudite, so he has more material. He knows more of the material that they want to cover with the children. Or he's just better at it. He's better qualified. He's more articulate. He encourages the children better. Lo misalkin enle. We do not remove him. Dilma ate lushule. We won't, because we're afraid he might become lazy. Le rachel means to be lazy, or the truth is it means to be weakened. We don't want him to be weakened by it. As to whom we are speaking about is not clear over here. Who is going to come weakened if we depose the existing teacher and put in a new teacher? So the answer might be that the new teacher. That's the way Rashi says. Because if he's going to become the new teacher, he's going to think that he is so good that he doesn't have to try so hard. They depose someone else, remove someone else to put him in place. So he thinks a lot of himself. He thinks so much of himself, he's not going to be so careful about the way he teach. He's going to be a little bit haughty. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, is that you're going to dishearten the teachers. Which is, if you fire this teacher, the next one who comes in is not going to try so hard, because he knows that as soon as you find someone better, you're going to fire him as well. So he doesn't have a vested interest in investing in the children here, because he could be fired just as fast as the one before him. The other possibility is to say that the person who was fired is going to be weakened or become despondent from the fact that he was let go, and that he'll stop teaching, which also be a negative, that we're going to lose this person as a teacher of children. So that's Rava's position. Rav Dimi Midara Daramar Koshikein the Garis Tfei. He says, no, you've got it backwards. You're looking at the psychology of what's happening here backwards. It actually is going to cause him to work harder. Kinat Sofrim Terbech Chochma. That jealousy amongst the Sofrim increases the wisdom. That competition is good for people to do better. That people, even within the education system, mean that the idea of sports and competition is true in academics as well. That whenever there's competition, people end up doing more or doing better because they worry about the other people. It's a natural part of a person's makeup, is that they are competitive. And that competitive nature will also help them to increase and do better. It doesn't have to be looked at as a negative trait. This could be a positive side, and that's what he's saying over here. The competition can be positive and result in better results for everyone. And then on all three of these situations, you have to argue the same thing. Here, where he was replacing the guy who was taken out, he won't get haughty about that because he is knows that the guy behind him, that's what Rashi says, is always looking over his shoulder. The guy got removed to put him in place. He's going to try and find mistakes with him. He's going to try to find a reason to replace him back. So therefore, he's going to make sure to be good, because otherwise, the other guy will get the job back. Or, the possibility we said is that person's going to be worried that you're going to fire him like you fired the guy before. That's exactly right. He's going to work a lot harder. He doesn't want to be fired like the previous guy. And therefore, he's going to work harder to ensure that he's not fired over here. Or, the guy who was removed is not going to be weakened or lazy anymore or just give up his job. He's going to try harder because he wants to get the job back, or he wants to not be released somewhere else. He wants to be able to do better. So he says that the things that you think, the psychology that's going to make it that people are disheartened by the removal of the teacher, he says, no, it's actually going to be a positive aspect to this, which is the competition will increase the quality of teachers and the quality of teaching that we are getting. Vamarava. One of them is good with the material. He has a vast library of material that he knows. But lo daik, he's not so careful. Whether that means he himself isn't so careful about, let's say, enunciation, pronunciation. He just runs through things. Or it means that he's not careful about the students getting it exactly right. I mean, he knows what he's doing, but the students, when they're learning from him, he basically assumes that they're getting it. He doesn't check so carefully if they're getting it. V'chad, on the other hand, we have another teacher, is Daik V'lo Goris. He is very good at the other aspect. He's very good at making sure that either the students know it, or he himself is very careful how he articulates, enunciates everything that he is saying. Then which teacher do we favor? Do we favor the more exacting and particular teacher, or do we favor the teacher who has a larger library or a store of material that he can share with the children? So Rova says over here, Motzvinin au de garis lo daik. He says, I'd rather get the person with the quantity than the quality. Shabishta memela nafka. Mistakes happen. Kids make mistakes. Kids have mistakes that happen. And that's irrespective of what the teacher does. Kids misunderstand the teacher, pronounce things incorrectly, even after the teacher is careful and checks on them and so on and so forth. Kids still make mistakes. So mistakes are going to happen anyway. If mistakes are going to happen anyway, then I may as well just give in to that and let that be the risk, because it's going to happen anyway. And then at least I'll get the quantity of material that I want. Rav Dimi Ben Daradaramar says, no, Motzvinan Daik Velogaris. He says just the opposite, because we'd rather have someone who is careful and the quality is higher than the quantity. Shabishta came into Al. A mistake that goes in when you're young and never leaves, which is that it's indelible, in the sense that once someone is taught something at their young age, it's very hard to undo what they've learned at a young age, so much so that it's a generation that's passing already, but the early generations of children who came to Israel, who had learned in Chadarim, in their home places, whether it's in the Sephardi areas in Tayman, or in the Ashkenazi places in Poland, and they knew Tanakh by heart. And no matter how hard they tried when they came here and they wanted to be secular and to forget that which they learned, they could never get it out of their heads because they were taught it as kids. And these people, you could bump into them in the street, completely secular, and they know Tanakh by heart, word for word, because they learned it when they were kids. It never leaves them. So that's his point over here, that once they learn something, it's not going to leave. Tzedichtiv, because now they tell the story. Kisheshit chodashim yashav sham Yoav, the whole Israel. So Yoav encamps over there with all of Israel. Ad hichrit kol zachar be'edom. Till he wiped out all the males in Edom. Kiatul kamei de David, when he returned back to see David, Amalei, my time of Adchachi. Why did you do this? Why are you killing out all the males? Rashi notes over here, why aren't you killing the females? Why are you just killing the males? Because the pasuk says, "Timche et zachar Amalek," to wipe out the males of Amalek. Amalek, va'anan zecher karina. Isn't the proper pronunciation zecher, not zachar? Isn't it the memory of Amalek, not the males of Amalek? So Amalek, ana zachar kirion. He says that when I learned it as a kid, I was taught that it was zachar. Also, shaili l'rabbi. He went back to his cheder teacher to find out what he taught him. Amalei, heyech akritan. How did you teach us? Amalei, zachar. He says, I taught you zachar. Shakol safsira lemiktale. You want to take out a sword to kill him. Amalei, amai. So they said, I don't think it's the Rebbe himself that says this, but the people there say, why are you going to kill him over this? This isn't something that you kill someone for. Amalei, dichtiv. Arur osim lechet Hashem remiyah. Cursed be the one who makes the work of Hashem into deception. So over here, you have a huge problem, which is this person is involved in Melechet Shemaim, the teaching of children, and he is feeding them the wrong material. He's teaching them the wrong thing. And when you're not careful, it has results that are everlasting and impactful when the person grows up. And over here, he's doing it in a way or in a manner that is of deceit. Okay. So you're right, but the Navi already tells you, Arur, he'll be cursed. Let the curse come upon him. Why do you have to go ahead and kill him? Which is, it's interesting, meaning that David HaMelech says the same thing to Bnei Tzuriah. When Shimei comes and curses David as he's leaving Yerushalayim in the merit of Shalom, the brothers Tzuriah, Yoav and his brother, want to go and kill Shimei. Why should we let this dog curse you, da 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 da, and they want to go kill him immediately? And David says, it's Me'ech Hashem, let him be. And the same thing when they come back to Yerushalayim, when Shimei comes to greet them, and he comes to basically apologize and try to placate David, Bnei Tzuriah again, Yoav and his brother want to kill him on the spot. How is this guy going to be left alive after what he did? And David again tells him, take it easy, you don't have to kill him. So I think it's the same idea where David says he'll meet his end. God will take care of this. This is in God's hands. You don't have to kill him in this case. And similarly over here, they're saying to Yoav, what do you need to kill him for? God already said he's going to be cursed. Let the curse take its effect. He says, I'm like, Dave, Varur Monea Charbo Midam, that the cursed is the one who holds his sword back from blood. Obviously, it doesn't mean that you need to be a killer. It means that where it's appropriate to kill, then the cursed is the one who doesn't kill in those situations. So sometimes when you hold yourself back and you think you're being merciful, in the end, you're actually doing the wrong thing. Because by not killing, you're actually causing more deaths or more problems because you aren't killing in those situations. Or you could say here, where there are life and death ramifications to the mistake, there the person is deserving of death because of the mistake, and therefore you don't withhold your sword in these cases, even though he has the arur. Here you have to kill him because he did something that had ramifications or repercussions in killing a people, or who should have been killed in this instance. Ikadamri katle, some say that he actually did kill him. Ikadamri lo katle, some say that he did not kill him in this instance. Alright, so there are a number of questions about this whole story. The first of which is very fundamental, is that there's a big difference between Edom and Amalek. Right? The requirement over here is for Amalek, and here we're speaking about Edom. Now, even though Amalek is a descendant of Edom, but all of Edom is not under this requirement to annihilate Amalek. So why is Yoav speaking, or Yoav and David speaking about Zecher or Zachar, when we're speaking about Edom, when are we dealing with Amalek? So you could argue that they were Edomites that had the Amalekim that were mixed up with them, that we do find a little bit, even though we find the Amalekim in the south of Israel, we do see that they have a close ties or associations with Edom at certain points. So you could argue that. The other way the Masha explains it over here is that he extrapolated. He thought this was the din by Amalek, and then he just extrapolated it to other nations. So yes, it's written by Amalek, but he thought this is the protocol by all nations. Now, in terms of the Zecher and the Zachar, it seems very strange that the teacher would have gotten this so completely wrong and taught to head Zachar Amalek. So many read over here that the teacher himself did not make the mistake. When he came and asked the teacher what it was, the teacher said Zecher. And I read it as Zachar because that's what it seems like. That was the mistake. But you could be that when Yoav showed up to the teacher and asked him, what did you say? And he said Zecher. So Yoav got angry at him because he never was midayek. He never checked the students whether the students were getting the right word. And so yes, he taught it correctly, but he wasn't ensuring that the students received it properly. And that's what Yoav was upset about, that he taught without being midayek. He didn't check on the quality of the communication that was going on, the education that was happening. That's what he's upset about. That's a little more palatable instead of having a teacher who completely misses the boat. The Bali Tosafot say that that is for sure the way to explain it, unlike what Rashi says over here, because it says, Arur Osem Lechet Hashem Rimi'ah. So that's called deceit. If he doesn't know what he's teaching and he teaches the wrong word, that's not deceit. That is a problem. That's a mistake. Rimi'ah is where there is something was right, but you're deceiving the other party. And that's what Yoav is complaining about. That's what the Bali Tosafot say is the Rimi'ah over here. The deceit is that you didn't teach me properly what was supposed to be said. And they're deceitful because you taught one thing, but you didn't ensure that I was getting the right thing. And therefore he calls it Rimi'ah. Others simply say that the Rimi'ah refers to the teacher himself. That he's a deceitful teacher because he hired himself out as a teacher when he didn't really know the material that he was giving. And that's the deceit that we're speaking about over here. Amarova. So this is a braita that we saw together at the end of Baba Metziah, and this is what actually compels Tosafot in the previous Amud to say that the Sofer Mato is the person who writes the shtarot for the city. And that is over here, Amar Rava, Mikre Yinoka, someone who teaches children, Shatla, someone who puts in vines for 50% of the output. We saw this at the end of Baba Metziah, we spent a lot of time on this, which is someone who is an expert at putting in vines and creating kramim and creating vineyards. So he hires himself out, and his payment is that he gets 50% of the output of the vineyard. Tabcho, a butcher. Umna, again, we'll assume here you could have one interpretation. Rashi and Baba Metziah said possibly Umna is a mohel, that he is a mohel. The other way is that he interpreted it over here, and the way the Bali Tosafot interpreted it is an Umna is a bloodletter. Visofer Mato. And then the Sofer Mata. This is Tosfot's proof, which is here in this brayta, you have both Mikra Yinoka and Sofer Mata. So if Rashi's right that the Sofer Mata is just a bigger teacher of children, then why over here do you have Mikra Yinoka and Sofer Mata? They should be one thing according to Rashi. They're the same type of individual. Because over here, size doesn't matter. We're going to see in a second. And therefore, they should be incorporated under the same title. The fact that the Braita separates them makes it sound like the Sofer Mata is a completely different trade or category. Rashi, again, in Bob Metzia, and we saw the Rabbeinu Gershon in the Pibi Samud, said that that is a barber, the city barber. On the other hand, we saw the Rabbeinu Hananel, who suggests that a Sofer Mata is literally that. He is the Sofer of the city who writes all the documents and books and letters, whatever everybody needs in the city. He's at the service of the city. He's the person who writes everything. Kulan kumutarim v'omdim ninu. They are on probation from the start. They don't need to be warned if they do something wrong that they're going to be dismissed or they're going to be fired. They, from the moment they start, their work is so essential or so delicate that if they do anything wrong, they're out immediately. We don't give them any second chances. So some of these are easy to understand. Let's talk about the umna. It is very easy to understand whether it's a blood letter or whether it is a moel. That mistake is life-threatening or people could die. Or if they have died from him, he's out because you don't take risks with these type of things. The tabcha, it seems, is a person who shechs and causes the animal to be an avela. So that's a serious issue because he's causing tremendous losses to other parties. Maybe even embarrassment to them because now they don't have what to feed the people that are coming over. In addition, you could argue that it is a tabcha that allows an nevela to go out. Even though it was a nevela, he still allowed it to be sold. So that's also another possibility. And both of those are untenable, unacceptable. Now, shat law is a little harder to understand, which is if he plants the vineyard improperly, then he just has to pay for it. He did nezek, and now he's got to pay for the nezek that he did. So Tosfot says that that can't be the explanation because it will just force him to pay. I think you could argue, and we saw this before in the Baal Tosfot as well, is that he may not have the money to pay. The reason he's doing the work in this way is because he doesn't have the money to buy his own land or to put out his own vineyards, so therefore he's doing it under the auspice of somebody else's ownership. That means that this person is not wealthy enough to maybe pay if he does nezek. So that would be a serious issue because it's nezek that he can't pay for. So that's problematic. And then Tosafot takes a different approach and says, no, he did plant the vines, but he does a poor job at it. So he says that's a permanent damage because of the fact that that's going to remain. This vineyard will always have this problem. It's going to have a subpar production, and you're never going to be able to replace it unless you rip the whole thing out and start again. That's a big loss to the Baal HaBayit. That's why he says the shatla is a problem. Mikra Yinoka. So Rashi says in Bava Metzia, the problem is Shavishta, if he makes mistakes. If the teacher of children makes mistakes, came into Al, once you make a mistake, that's permanent or indelible in terms of the child. If that's the case, then we've got to throw this guy out because you keep him around, he's going to cause big problems in the long run. Right, so that's the connection to the previous case. The big, big difficulty with that, and the Baal HaTosfot pointed out both in Bava Metzia and here as well is, our memory is Va'omar Rava. Rava is the author of this memra. Rava is the author of the position on the previous amud that says that if I have a choice between quantity and quality, I'll take quantity. Because kids make mistakes anyway. He does not have this principle of mistakes being permanent, and he doesn't worry about it. So Rava l'shitato would not be worried about that, and that, according to the Baal HaTosfot, can't be the reason for mikra darki. So Tosfot offers something over here, and as well as in Bava Metzia, which is Omeri, Davab Seda, Delohadar, Da'oto Sha'ah, Shalomed. Time is lost. And the time that he taught him the wrong thing, that's time that can never be made up for. And instead of teaching him the right thing, he's teaching him the wrong thing, he caused him to waste time. And that's something you can never replace, that's something you can never make up for, and therefore, you have to remove him immediately because he's causing this huge loss of time for children who are learning the wrong things and then have to be corrected afterwards. I think that you could argue that that is the problem in itself, which is that when he teaches something wrong, to undo it and to teach them the new thing, even if you believe they can do it, still, it's a problem because the amount of time that's been invested to change whatever was done wrong originally. But that's what the Baal HaTosfot would say. It's the wasted time that we throw him out from. And then, Sofer Mata. So Sofer Mata, Rashi over here says, Lavlar. Over here he says, a Sofer. Again, Rashi on the previous Amud says that the Sofer Mata was this principal or larger guy. Over here, Rashi says he's a Lavlar, he's a Sofer that writes Sifrei Torah. And therefore, over here, the problem of why he's Mutarim Ve'omdim is because he's going to cause a loss. He writes a Sefer Torah that has a mistake in it. That's a very large loss. Sifrei Torah expensive. You make a mistake, that's a real problem. Tosfot rejects that and says the Sefer Torah can be fixed. You can fix mistakes in a Sefer Torah. It's not like tefillin where you have to write them kesidra and you have to write them in order. You make a mistake and you can't fix it afterwards. Over here, if the mistake is made in the middle of a Sefer Torah, you can go back and fix it after the fact. So that's not a loss that's not recoverable. That's something you can recover from. So those that answer on behalf of Rashi say that it was a loss because there are too many mistakes. It's not that there's one mistake or two mistakes that need to be fixed. There's such a large number of mistakes that it makes it untenable to fix it at this point, and that's why there's a great loss over here. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot over here reiterate what they said on the previous Amud and say that Sofer Mata is the same Sofer Mata that we were talking about on the previous Amud, which is the documenter, the first scribe for the city. Someone who does the shtarot, someone who does all the writing for the city. And over there, it's a big risk. If he's writing the shtarot incorrectly, he's putting the wrong information to him, he's advising people incorrectly on these things, these are serious issues that cause big losses to people that are unrecoverable. And therefore, we're going to fire him because we can't have a person like this that's misguiding the city as the sofer. So therefore, the klalo de milto, the Gemara says, is kol pseida de lo hadar. Anytime you have a loss that's unrecoverable, mutra ba'omeidu, that person is on probation from the moment they're involved in that profession. Whereas, if it's something that can be recovered or rectified, then you have to give him a warning before you fire him. Amar Rav Huna, hai bar mivoa, du'uke reichaya, he sets up a mill. Va'atar bar mivura chabre, and then his neighbor in the mavui comes along, ve'kamuke gabe, and he sets up another mill over there. Dinahu d'ma'akev ilave. He can stop him. Damalei kamasatli l'chiyuti. You are creating unfair competition over here. You're basically stealing my customers. I was here first. I had my mill here first. And in those days when people had a mill, not everybody had a mill. So the people who didn't have a mill had to hire the people who did own the mills to mill the items for them. So over here, Rav Huna is saying that if the guy already has shop set up in this mavui, to put another Rechaim in that Mavoi would create unfair competition and would create a problem for him where he's going to say, you're going to diminish my business. Lema misayile. Let us say that this Braita helps him. Marchikim mitzudata dag min adag. Kamalo ritzata dag. You have to distance the fish nets from the fish, the amount of roam that a dag, a fish runs. Vikamo, how much is that? Amarabba baruna ad parsa. That is at least a parsa. Shiny dagim, the Gemara says, no, you can't prove anything from there. Dagim are different. Diavi siara. Because they get their eye on something. Rashi explains over here, what's happening here is that there is a fisherman who's figured out where the fish are living, found out their home, and he is basically baiting those fish to come out. So he has located their hole, as Rashi says. He's putting the food there to draw them out. And then he wants to have his nets to catch the fish to come out. If the other fishermen come and put their nets there, then they're going to impinge on his fishing rights that he has over here. So now, the right that he has is that he's identified the location, and he is making efforts to bring the fish out. If we let other people come, then all of his efforts will be for naught, because other people are going to capture the fish. So we give him room, which is Milei Ritzat Dag, the amount of space by which this fish would swim around, or the local area where he swims, so he gives him the ability to capture the fish without other people crossing into his territory. So Rashi explains over here that he identified the hole of the fish, and then he's put out a mizonot, and he's attracted the fish, and therefore, Bavadai, almost certainly he's going to come into this person's net, because of the setup or the circumstances that we have here. On the other hand, with regards to the Rechaim setting up the competing mills in the Mavoi, there's no guarantee that parties will go to one mill over the other mill. It's a fair competition for the customers in this case. Or you could explain that one puts out bait to come. The area in which that bait is effective is a parsa. So if someone else comes in and tries to catch in that area, they're basically beneficiaries of the bait that this individual is putting out there, and therefore it's considered to be stealing or impinging on his parnasa versus the rechayim, by which people come and make their own decisions. They're not affected, quote unquote, by the bait to come there. And they make a free choice as to go whether to go one mill or the other mill, and therefore it's not unfair competition. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here suggests that the problem is that if someone is already out there with a net, and maybe even bait, if you come along and put other bait within that parsa, the fish are going to go flying out of his net to go to the other individual's net, because they see bait over there. So if he impinges on that parsa, he's actually going to attract the fish out of your net into his net. And that's what the problem is over here, that there's really almost gezel gamor, that you're actually causing the fish to leave the first fisherman's net to come to the second fisherman's net, and that we won't allow. But again, by the rechayim, you don't have that problem, because you're not forcing people to go into yours versus his. They again have free choice to decide which mill they're going to go to. But again, this idea that you have some sort of territorial rights once you put your net down, that other people can't come there and put their nets down, because we want to keep the competition fair, or the people who are investing to do this, that they get some benefit from it. The Baal Yom Tov Sofot already discussed over here what exactly is the repercussions of impinging on those rights. If someone impinges on those rights, do we say therefore they're called a rasha? That person's evil, that person's doing the wrong thing over here? Or are we simply making a suggestion that people don't do this, but they're not called a rasha? The key distinction that Tosfot makes is whether the item is replaceable. Is there a possibility to replace that item? If it's an item that you could find somewhere else, then we're going to say to you, you're a rasha if you come and take it from the other party. On the other hand, if it's a unique item, of which there's only one, for instance, Tosfot gives the example of a mitziah. Somebody finds a mitziah over here. If you let the other person take it, then there's no replacement mitziah. There's only one mitziah. So if you jump the gun and take it in that case, that's an irreplaceable item. And therefore, you're not called a rasha in that case because you have no other choice. I can't say to you, just go find it somewhere else. And therefore, when it comes to items of hefker, we don't assume that a person has taken possession of the item of hefker to get exclusive rights to it. And if another person comes and snatches it away from him, not called a rasha in that case. Over here, we're talking about fish, which are things that are hefker. Nevertheless, over here, we're pushing against him doing this is because it's just as easy for him to set up his net somewhere else as to set up over here. Given that, even though it's hefker, and we don't give the fishermen a right over here, nevertheless, we're going to advise you to move away. And you might be called a rasha if you take it from him because of the fact that it's just as easy for you to go set up somewhere else, so why impinge on someone else's rights? Or you can argue that there's a difference between when we're talking about finding a mitziah or finding something that's hefker versus dealing with someone's livelihood. When it deals with someone's livelihood, we're going to have a higher standard of how to act in those cases so that you don't hurt this person's livelihood. Gemara continues, says, Lema Ravuna Damarka Rabbi Yehuda. Let us suggest that Ravuna holds to the position of Rabbi Yehuda, which we saw in the Mishnah in Bava Mitziah. Because over there we said that tonight Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Lo Yechalek Chenvani Klayot Ve'Gozim Letinokot. The Rabbi Yehuda says the storekeeper should not hand out roasted nuts and other nuts or delicacies to the children, gifts to the children, Mipnei Shemargalin Etzlo, because then he increases their traffic. The father sends out the kid to go pick up something from the store. He has to pick which store he's going to go to. They're always going to go to the store where they give him a little candy, where they give him a sweet. That's what's going to drive him to go to that store. Chamim Matirim. The Chamim say, no problem. Because the Chamim say, just like he's giving out sweets, you want to compete, you do the same advertising, you do the same marketing, and you'll end up with the same customers. It's not unfair. He's not doing something which you can't replicate. You can replicate it, and you do the same thing. So now what we're suggesting is Rav Huna says that it's unfair competition. To open up a mill in the same mavoi is like Rabbi Yehuda, who says that it's unfair to have these practices that take away from your friend's ability to make a parnasa. On the other hand, the Chachamim say it's totally fine, and they would say it's fine over here. It says, Afilu teime Rabbanan. You could even say that Rav Huna holds like the Rabbanan. Ad kan lo pligi Rabbanan alei, the Rabbi Yehuda, hatam. The only reason they disagree with Rabbi Yehuda over there is El Damar lei, because he can say to the other storekeeper, I'm handing out these nuts. you should hand out shaviski, Rashi says, are shkedim, almonds. So you should give out almonds. Although in Bava Metzia, Rashi says that shaviski are prunes, whereas the Rabbeinu Hananel suggests that they are peaches. So I'm giving out walnuts, you give out almonds. I'm giving out this nut, you give out a different nut. Meaning that you can compete. Of a halacha, I feel the Rabbanan modu. But maybe over here, even the Rabbanan agree that he's doing something that is not going to be able to replace. He is coming in and basically going to take away customers or business. And that's not something where he can do anything more to compete because he's just opened up shop in the exact same location and providing the same service. You are diminishing my parnasa. Meitave, is that really true? Person's allowed to open up a store next to the store of his friend. We can open up a bathhouse next to the bathhouse of his friend. He's not allowed to stop him. I'll do my business, you do your business, and we'll compete for the customers. So there's no problem with competition. You can have competition that opens up, and from this bright, it sounds like explicitly that we might even encourage competition, and the other party can say, you want to compete? That's fine. God will provide us both parnasa if there's room for parnasa. If not, God will give it to whoever deserves the parnasa. Reminds me of a famous joke, which I always tell to my children, an important lesson in life, which is, was this individual at a bakery on the corner, and he was doing a great business, and then all of a sudden, a bakery opened up on the opposite corner. And he's watching as the bakery on the opposite corner starts to take away all of his business, and it's doing better and better and better. And he goes to the Rav, and he goes to ask him, what's going on here? You know, I had a great business, then this guy opened up on the other side, and now I lost all my business. Listen, you know what he's doing? I see the customers are coming in. He's getting up at this time in the morning. He's baking the bread. He's putting out the cakes and all of this stuff. And on and on and on about the other bakery. And he says to the Rav, what should I do? He says, I'll tell you the problem. The other guy on the other side of the road is only managing one bakery. You on this side of the road are managing two bakeries. You're managing your bakery and his bakery. And that's why you can't get things done. That's what's being said here. You do your thing, I'll do my thing, and Baruch Hashem, all of us will have our parnasa. There's an idea that sometimes it's important, along the lines of minding your own business, which is mind your own bakery, which is take care of what you need to take care of. Don't worry about someone else's bakery, you deal with your bakery, and Hashem will provide for you. Tanayehi, it is actually a machloket tanayim. Tanya. Kufim b'nei revolt zetzeh, shlolashi b'neim, Benevol can agree between them or force each other not to put a chayat, a tailor, below burski, not a tanner, below melamei tinokot, and not a teacher of children, below echad mimnei balei umenayot, and any other one of the professions that's out there, ulishcheno eno kofeyu, but his neighbor he cannot stop. So now, what seems to be the distinction that's being drawn over here is that if there's already a professional in this mavoi who is doing this job, then you can prevent someone from coming in from the outside, another mavoi, and setting up shop over here in this mavoi. But what he cannot do is the shcheino. If the person lives in the mavoi, then he has a right to do it just like you have a right. So if you are local to the mavoi, then you can open up a shop just like he opened up a shop, and you can't prevent him. If it's someone who lives somewhere else, and now he's going to rent the space here to open up a shop in this mavoi, that you have a right to block his opening up of the store. Because he can say to him, this is my territory, this is my mavoi. If you want to say you lived here, that's one thing. But if you don't live here, we're not going to give you the rights to open up. But the Shechino, he can't stop him. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Atlu Shechino Kofeyu. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, even his neighbor, meaning even someone who's local to this mavoi, he can stop from opening up this shop. So in essence, what we're saying is that Rav Huna holds like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rav Huna says that an individual can prevent another party within his mavoi from opening up shop. He holds like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, says that you can stop a local party from opening up a competing business. Whereas the Chachamim say that's not a problem. You can only stop someone who's coming from the outside. So Tosfot over here says the Melamei Tinokot that we're speaking about over here is Melamei Tinokot Nachrim Ayri. Talking about a Melamei Tinokot of Nachrim. And that is only true, Tosfot says, if on the previous Amud, your Goreis instead of Mavoi Chatzer. Because on the previous Amud, we saw that the B'nai Mavoi can block a person from setting up a secular studies school. So over here, where you're saying that the only reason you can block them is because of competition, and even Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who allows you to block when it's someone who's a local member of this mavoi, that's only because of the competition issue, not because of the noise issue. Yet on the previous amud, we said that when it came to secular schools, you have a right to object to their being set up. Now, if you say on the previous amud that that was a chatzer and not a mavoi, then you can understand the difference, that there, by a chatzer, you can stop them. By the mavoi, you cannot stop them. And that would be the difference between the two cases. But if you have the gears of mavoi over there, then you have a problem, because in the brayto, there is stira, which is there you said that you can block a person from setting up secular studies. And over here, you say that you can't block them unless it's a competitive issue. The other hand, the Rosh Mishnah says that we're talking about Jewish students over here. We're talking about a religious school. And despite that fact, you're allowed to block it. Even though in the previous amud we said you're not allowed to block a Melamed Dino code from setting up shop, the Rosh Mishnah says that's only true when there's not an existing school. If there's no school there, then you can demand that they open up a school, or you can tell the parties that they don't have a right to object to you opening up a school. But once there's already one school or cheder open over there, you can't say then that, oh, let's open up a second one. Then already it becomes an issue, and you can't object to the second school or cheder being opened in that location. So now, Amar Rabuna Brei de Rabbi Yeshua. Pshitali, it's clear to me, bar mata achrite matzim akev. If an individual from another city comes to open up professionally in this city, that the existing professional in this city can reject that and say that that's unfair competition. You're coming from the outside, you don't live locally, you don't have a right to come and compete with me in this city. It says that, I think, is clear. Vishayach bekargo da'ocha lo matzim akev. If he pays the same taxation, so they're under the same auspices or the same governor, so they're paying taxes to the same authority, that's considered to be one area. So it doesn't literally mean he has to be in the city itself, but even the suburbs around the city, if they're paying their taxes to the same authority, then they're considered to be in one area. That is, the perimeter or the limits are determined by the tax authority in that area. Bar mivoa, denafshe lo matzimakit. He says, on the other hand, when it comes to one party in a mavoi, and another party who lives in that mavoi, everyone agrees there that you have no right to stop him from opening up a competing business. By Rav Huna, Brother Yeshua, the queer time where I have a question is, bar mavoa, a bar mavoa achrino. We're talking about a bar mavoa that's coming from another mavoi into this mavoi, and wants to open up a shop. Does he have a right to do that? Or does the person who has his shop set up already over there, can he reject that and object to the opening of a competing business inside of his mavoi by a party on the outside? He says, my, what's the din here? Teiku. He leaves that as being unresolved. Now, so number one, what's clear here is that Rav Huna Brei de Rav Yeshua holds like the Rabbonon and not like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Because he makes it clear that a person who lives in the mavoi has a right to open up without any questions about competition. The only question is what is it meant by when the Rabbonon say, bar mavoa, bar mavoa? Is he talking about someone inside of that mavoi? Or is he talking about any bar mavoi? Anybody who lives in that locale can open up a shop. And that's his uncertainty as to what the Rabbanan's meaning is of a bar mevoa. So the question is, according to the Chachamim, what's the difference between a Shechein and a B'nai Mavoi? When is he considered to be a Shechein where he has a right to set up shop? And when is he considered to be a B'nai Mavoi that he can't set up shop? Where is the threshold between whether you're considered to be local and where you're considered not to be local? And that's the distinction where the Chachamim say that you can open up if you're local, but you can't open up if you're not local. Where is that threshold? And that's the question of Rav Huna Brei de Rav Yeshua. As Tosfot explains over here, what it means is that the people of the city can't block another person in the city from opening up a shop. That is in the city as a whole. But the B'nai Mavoi, the people who live in a particular neighborhood, if there's already a professional there, they can't stop the professional from coming in. We're just talking at the city level, that we allow competition. As long as you're a member of the city, we allow you to open up. In terms of competition, that doesn't mean you have a right to go into someone else's mavoi and open up a shop. It means that in commercial areas of the city, we allow you to open up a shop. But within a particular mavoi, there still is a non-compete from people who are outside of that mavoi, and therefore you have to live in the mavoi to gain those rights to open up a shop that's there. And that is what is meant in the Braita, Kofim b'nei mivo'ot, zeh, shlo lo shiv b'neihem. Then, Rav Huna Brei de Rav Yeshua's question is, in a case where a person wants to set up right outside this mavui. Since it's not in the particular mavui, is that considered to be okay? Or because it's so close to this mavui, it's as if he's entering or going into this mavui. On the other hand, the Ramban believes that the braita that says, Kofim b'nei b'avot, zeh sh'olu shi b'neihem, that's talking about an individual who is a taxpayer in this city, but does not live in one of the mivaot of the city. And that's why he's precluded from setting up in any mavui. On the other hand, if a person is a member of the city who lives in one of the mivaot of the city, the question of Rav Huna b'Rebbe Yehoshua is then he precluded from opening up in another mavui. Because Shcheino might be a case where mavui to mavui is fine, and the restriction against setting up in a mavui is only if you're an outsider where it does not live in any of the mivaot of the city. Whereas for the Ritva and the Balei HaTosafot, by definition, if you don't live in this mavui, you have no right to be in there. The only question is, if you are now a member of another mavui and you want to open up adjacent to this mavui, but not in the mavui itself, is that considered to be a shachain, and therefore you are mutar to open it up because you're outside the mavui? Or is that still considered to be as if you're opening up inside the mavui and we won't permit it?
As Tosfot notes over here, the fact that Rav Huna b'Rebbe of Yeshua holds like the Rabbanan versus Rav Huna holds like Rav Shimon Gamliel, that will be the halacha, since Rav Huna b'Rebbe of Yeshua is a batra, is a later amora, and therefore we're going to pask him like him, which means the halacha is going to be like the Chachamim and not like Rav Shimon Gamliel, even though Rav Huna paskin like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Amar Rav Yosef, umolde Rav Huna b'mikrei darke delo matzi ma'akev. Rav Yosef says that Rav Huna before, who says you have a right to stop someone from opening up a competitive business in your mavoi, in your chatzer, that is only true when you're talking about professions. When we're talking about religious studies, when we're talking about a cheder, there you don't have a right to object. Damar mar, because we have a memra that tells us, Kinot Sofrim Tarbech Chochma. So that's the same thing that we saw in the previous Amud, which is that competition is good for the increasing of wisdom. And given that, it's a worthwhile endeavor to open up another cheder because that will increase competition, and that competition will be beneficial to the students. Part of the Gemara that's in parentheses, that Amar Mar, Ezra Tiken Lemisrael Shumo Shivim Sofer Betzad Sofer. Ezra was metakein that teachers can open up next to other teachers. Though why don't we worry about them weakening or the problem of the competition causing the fact that they will knock out a player or cause a teacher either not to work as hard or cause a teacher to lose faith in his ability to teach. So why don't we worry about that? Then the answer of the Gemara to that is, Kinat Sofrim Tarbech Chochma. So therefore, competition is good in these situations, not negative. Tosafot eliminates this part in the parentheses from the Girsa, because he says, if you look in the Gemara and Bava Kama, that's not one of the takanot that's listed of Ezra. On the other hand, there were Rishonim who argued that that was the Girsa that was found in their Gemaras. Therefore, they maintain that part of the Girsa, even though that takana does not appear in Bava Kama. And that's where the Tosafot said before, when the Rosh Mishnah said that the Mikre Darbiki that was mentioned in the Bright and Machlok between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was talking about, even if you were talking about a Cheder, then you would have to say over there that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel doesn't argue about the Cheder, because Rav Huna, who holds like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, is saying that a Cheder is not subject to these rules, even though Mikre Darbiki was mentioned in that Bright. That's what compels the others who explain that that's talking about secular studies and not religious studies, because then you won't have a problem here of a steer about what Rav Yosef says in the position of Rav Huna versus what's said in the Braita of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Now then, the Balei Tosfot just suggests that when Rabbi Shimon Gamliel argued in that Braita, he was arguing on all the other issues, but not on the Mcheder. And that's what Rav Yosef is coming to tell us, that Rav Huna meant when he agreed to the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, he said that's true, but the Mikrei Darduki is not that way. In Mikrei Darduki, you should increase competition, or it's alright to have competition. Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchak, Umodah Rav Huna b'Rebbe Rav Yehoshua. Rav Huna b'Rebbe Rav Yehoshua, Beruchlin HaMachzirin Bayirut, Delo Matzi Ma'akev. Even Rav Huna b'Rebbe Rav Yehoshua says that if you come from outside the city, you have a right to stop the individual from coming in and competing. It's true in all professions, with the exception of perfumer makeup sellers that come from city to city. Delo Matzi Ma'akev, because there you can't stop him. Damar Ma'ar, because again here we have another memra from the Gemara in Bava Kama about the 10 takanot that Ezra put in place. One of those takanot was, Tamar Ezra Tikein Lemisro, Shiyu Rochlim Makzirim Bayerot, that Ezra was mitakein that these perfume sellers can go from city to city, Kadeshu Takshitim Mitsuim, the Benot Israel, so that there'll be a large supply of makeup, jewelry, and perfume for the Benot Israel, in order that they should be beautiful and be able to attract their husbands. So we want this to take place. So we were looking actually for a lot of competition and a reduction in prices. And therefore, that's the takana that we allowed outside competitors to come in and to open up businesses, even though they don't belong to this city. That's only true if they're iterant sellers. But we don't let them set up a permanent shop here. Only allow them to go from house to house and do it as a mobile salesman, but not as a fixed store. If he's a young Talmud Chacham, then we even allow him to set up shop because he needs to make a living in a short period of time so that he can spend the most of his time in learning. Rova allowed these two young Amoraim to set up shop to Loki Ilchota, even though it was not, quote-unquote, within the bounds of the law. He did it lifnim mishurat hadin. He did it outside the bounds of the law. My taima came into Rabbanon, you know, since they are young Talmidei Chachamim, atu l'tardu migirsayu. They will be weighed down by the burdens of making a living, and then they will forget their learning. So in order to facilitate their ability to learn and still make a living to support themselves in their learning, we give them special rights to override what normally would be non-compete rules. So even though normally the non-compete rules will say if you're from outside the city, we won't let you open up a permanent shop, only be a iterant seller, for these chachamim or these talmidei chachamim, we will allow them to set up shop and make a living here so as to facilitate their ability to be talmidei chachamim. So it's a special dispensation to go lifnei mishurat hadin for these talmidei chachamim. And so that's a qualifier to this restriction against opening up a permanent shop in a non-compete zone.